Hello again.
Hey.
So there you are in Gaza. And you've been there for how long?
Last year I spent 3 months in Gaza, and this year I will spend more than 6 months. Last year I came here twice, both for about 6 weeks, and so far I've been here just 4 days.
Okay, because it is difficult to get in and out, and they limit your time there, the visas.
Actually, no, it's not difficult to get in and out, and they do not limit your time. But there may be slight difficulty is for the people who do not have the friends here, mm-hmm. or the contacts here, to find the right invitation. If you do not have an invitation, then you cannot come.
Okay, I see. Because I actually spent, in 2009, I spent about 6 weeks on the West Bank. And in a place where people were coming in and out, and many of them did have to leave after the left because of the Israelis. You go in through Rafah, though, right?
Yes, indeed. Oh, yes, yes.
And that
yes.
makes a huge difference. I flew into Israel, so. This is your office. You have people working there besides yourself?
Actually, no. I'm just sitting in a cafe. We've been working on a convoy to bring internationals to Gaza the last couple of days, me and some of my colleagues. But we're just having some downtime watching a documentary, an Arabic language documentary that my friend here made. Took her 2 months, and it was about journalists here during the recent wartime, and I was one of the people in the documentary, so we were just looking at it, you know, talking about it.
Okay, that's interesting, because I know they target journalists. You've been lucky so far.
Yeah, I mean, they during the war, they killed 3 journalists. And according to Israel, they were not journalists, they were militants. But to the Palestinians, they were journalists, not militants. And Israel has yet to provide any evidence to back up its claim that they were militants. And the point is that from the kind of general Palestinian perspective, this shows the gravity and the profundity of how far Israel is willing to go in causing civilian damage and barbarity, you know, seen as a kind of example of a massacre, actually.
Well, it was a massacre, I would think, by the definition
Indeed.
Of the word,
Indeed.
The number of dead. I mean, it is interesting. I heard you in one of your films say that 1 Israeli had been killed by Hamas fire. I got the figure 3. That's incidental because compared to
it was six was the final number that we got after the war finished, but if you go to Wikipedia it still says 4, so we're using that number because I'm sure Wikipedia would have the highest number if they could find it.
Absolutely. Okay, but in any case, that is even that takes it out of context as I understand it, because if you go to the time period before the latest mass murder, which was in November of 2012, I think it was 174 Palestinians.
I don't know the exact time frame, but if you take what happened in the week before the operation, a handful of Palestinians were killed, including children.
They always pick an arbitrary point where an Israeli has been killed, and then it goes forward.
Exactly. And if they choose when the clock starts.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you go and look at it over history, and if you look at it over time, it's always in the quiet periods when nobody is reporting it.
This is the important thing, that regional quiet is when Israelis are not killed and Palestinians are killed.
Precisely.
And trouble is when Israelis get injured, basically.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's 6 to 7 times, and I looked at these statistics for a long time before I went over there, and I was there in 89, 90, and 2005, and 2009, so I have a history, you know, I mean, I understand this over time, and it's important to see it over time, but anyway, right now, at this moment in time, I imagine things in Gaza are pretty bad. You talk about that after this bombing and...
So the situation in Gaza today is that the humanitarian crisis continues, and the same sad figures continue, which is that most people are refugees, most people are living in refugee camps, most people are relying on food aid so that they don't starve to death, and most of the population are children. living in absolute insecurity, physical insecurity, because there is a chance that a war can start again at any time, and the resistance groups, the militant groups, the terrorist groups, whatever what you want to call them, are preparing all the time for Israel launching another operation against them. There's also economic insecurity because the blockade has shrunk the economy and it makes most people unemployed. Most of my friends have no job. At the same time, there's a historical insecurity because no one knows what's going to happen to the Israel-Palestine conflict. Is there going to be a right of return? Is there not going to be a right of return? Is there going to be one state, two states, three states, 25 states? We don't know. So there is an absolute full spectrum insecurity. At the same time, there is, and it must be stressed, a very hopeful essence and feeling here. And most people, you know, when you visit Gaza and you spend time meeting people and etc., and you spend time meeting ordinary people, people who are not part of some kind of elite here, you don't get the impression that most people are dealing with manic depression because of the situation. There is a very strong spirit of resilience, steadfastness, and, if you like, spiritual resistance, which goes on here, which is very manifest and really almost touchable. At the same time, one of the really striking things, having just been here for 4 days on this, my third trip, that always hits me, and it's devastating, is the inequality here. Most people are living in absolutely dire conditions. While there are mansions, shopping malls, five-star hotels, and etc. And one asks oneself, exactly what's happened to charity? Exactly what's happened to equality in these parts?
I did see that when I was there. It's, you know, when I went to the Gaza, and the last time, the only time I got there was in 89-90, I was startled by the harsh living conditions then. And I also see, though, and did see what you see, is that these people manage to keep their spirits up in a way that is extraordinary, considering the conditions that people in the West and many nations now consider normal.
Exactly.
Those conditions are horrible. It is the constant threat of violence and the being trapped in there. I read several years ago that the Israelis were planning to build a wall around Gaza. Did that ever happen?
Or is it Israel has a wall or fences around Gaza, the parts of the border that it controls. And they are actually, generally speaking, on the internationally designated border. They're not particularly annexing like in the West Bank.
Mm-hmm. Right, but it still traps the people there.
The people cannot leave. They cannot go back to what was their land 65 years ago. Israel, they cannot really go near the border still in many cases because of being shot at and insecurity. Just this morning, farmers were shot at farming in their own land near the border with Israel. So there's kind of a stealing of the land in the sense of security is stolen. The same with the territorial waters. They are stolen in the sense that there's insecurity. One cannot really go into the territorial waters beyond 3 nautical miles or even within 3 nautical miles from the coastline. There is really a great deal of insecurity. And many of my friends are horrified, for example, at the thought of even going in a boat into the water. So there certainly is this insecurity continuing.
Right. Now, I remember one of the stories that came out of there was of a family that went to the beach and were killed. I think most of the family, except one child, one daughter, was killed. But anyway,
indeed,
it's one of those stories, and there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of those stories. Another question I had is several years ago, I was reading that UNRWA was actually cutting back on their, because they are, in essence, keep the Palestinians going.
Indeed.
And that they were cutting back. Do you know anything
actually,
about that?
Actually, I've not heard any such thing. But we can take, for example, one takeaway from the situation with UNRWA. During the 8-day war in November, UNRWA, it says it was able to continue its provision of aid at a normal pace, which is good. At the same time, the whole, as much as aid is needs to be given and is a basic human transaction, if you will, it kind of makes, in a sense, more politically or diplomatically comfortable the situation in Gaza, which could make it harder to actually bring actual freedom to Gaza, if that makes sense.
Right. It perpetuates the situation.
A kind of aid-dependent status, indeed.
Right. But they couldn't, on the other hand, exist without it. So it's
indeed, indeed.
Both
the thing is, how is this then exploited for political reasons?
Of course.
Is this exploited by Israeli, Palestinian, and international political factions for their benefit, so that they don't really have to address the situation in Gaza, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. No, that's true. And it seems there are no real solutions. And the real solutions are actually very obvious. It's just to stop mass murder and allow these people to build up an economy and trade with the people they choose to trade with.
Indeed.
But that's, of course, not going to be done. One thing I wanted to talk about also was the medical situation, because I know from the war on Gaza in 2008-09, that was Christmas over that season, that they targeted hospitals, doctors. Well, that's
indeed
historic. And that goes
indeed
back. So that makes it, what's the condition of the hospitals when you have over 1,400 people wounded, and many of them severely, and that's another story, the kind of weaponry used. But what happened, or do you know how many of those have died? How many, of course, are left permanently injured, which is a small aspect of this that's not discussed?
I think that you're talking about doctors injured and et cetera. I don't know the figures, but what I can tell you is that during the Operation Carstadt massacre, the so-called 22-day war that you're referring to, hospitals were directly targeted by Israel. Hospitals were directly targeted. In the recent 8-day war, there were one or two instances where hospitals were directly targeted. And so there has been, if you like, an improvement. I mean, the situation is that Operation Carstadt was so lunatic and so barbaric, so beyond the pale, that it was almost not real. You know, you almost couldn't have dreamed of something so much of a massacre, yeah? And it received so much international condemnation. What Israel did just this winter in November, the 8-day war, couldn't have been as much. It couldn't have been as much, and it wasn't as much in terms of these sorts of targetings of hospitals and et cetera. And so in this sense, there is an improvement which we can mark, which says that over time Israel is getting away with less, and there's less and less that it can do, and it's being more and more restricted. And so I think this is something we have to cling on to as a means of hope. The point is that in the recent 8-day war, thousands were injured. The numbers vary, and of course it's difficult during a wartime to exactly catalogue how many people are injured and etc. But the numbers vary between 1,400 and 2,000. The point is, let's say, not to mention psychologically, but physically, well over 1,000 have been injured. But the point is that those that are injured from this recent war and from escalations of violence, small wars in between this and the one of 2008-09, The scars are on people's minds, the scars are on people's hearts, the scars are on people's bodies, the scars are on people's livelihoods, the scars are on the buildings, the scars are on the sand, the scars are on the social fabric. And so the pain lives on. It doesn't just because the war stop. It goes on. I mean, just now we're watching, before we started this interview, watching a documentary about the war. And the point is that for so many Palestinians, so many living in Gaza, the effects of the war are still being exacted on them today.
Yeah.
In Israel, that isn't the case, actually.
No, it's not, because there's so minimal, the damage is so minimal, it's almost laughable. And that's
exactly.
But that I understand, you know, you want to take hope no matter what, but the simple fact is also, if you look at the situation again when it's not in the headlines, is this war continues in the middle in a lot of very subtle, constant, daily ways. I mean, they may settle for occasional bombings of 1,000 and kill 1,000 people or something, or injure 1,000, but it's that daily war. I mean, the famines, really this insane penning these people in and starving them to death, because that's really what the Israeli policies are. I mean, if you just cut people off completely from the world and they monitor every aspirin in and every tomato out, then it's been referred to as the world's largest open-air prison.
Largest open-air prison, indeed.
So
I mean, the thing here is that Israel withdrew a few years ago because it could no longer manage Gaza. Yeah, you know, it could no longer afford, or it felt found it no longer economically appropriate to exact the military occupation on the ground in Gaza like it's doing in the West Bank. it was no longer efficient for it. And so then it just puts it behind a wall, blocks it in, and shows that Egypt blocks it in, and shows that the world considers whatever is inside terrorist. Mm-hmm. And that's its way of dealing with Gaza. Basically, as you say, imprison the population, get on with life if they want, if they can try, and given the besiegement conditions, a diet, as we now know is what their intention was, to put the Palestinians in Gaza on a diet. And that's how they deal with Gaza. It's like the backyard for them, actually.
It is. I mean, it is incredible. What is even more incredible is that the international community hasn't done anything, truly. Individuals have. They've stood up, and they've, of course, tried to go in there with the flotillas and break the barricades and bring people food and medicines, things they need, and show that they have support, which I think they would also be
Indeed.
In dire need of the knowledge that the world has not completely abandoned them. But
exactly.
It still is very little in a sea of what, how do they cope? I mean, how do they keep going? They live out of their gardens. They get a few packages of flour from UNRWA.
Well, there is enormous inequality here. We're talking about most Palestinians. The vast majority are living on food handouts, exactly as you allude to. And Gaza is agriculturally independent. And this is one success, is that all of the fresh fruit and veg and etc. is grown in Gaza. There is autonomy in this respect, which is a marvel. I mean, this is one of
it
the
is.
Things about, I want to say, sort of Palestinian culture is this notion of living off and loving the land and making the most of it. And in this sense, the Israeli treatment of the Palestinians reminds me of the American treatment of the Native Americans. That is, killing off, if you will, or to an extent trying to kill off the native people who can actually sustainably live on the land without destroying the planet.
Well, I'll tell you something you may want to consider, that American Indians or American Aboriginals or Natives or however you want to phrase them have under their control millions of acres of land that they can farm and do, and they also have the casino well. So, in fact, they live considerable. I mean, there's no comparison. The casinos at Cherokee Reservation, which is near where I live, bring in millions of dollars. They have a beautiful 5-star hotel, a 14,000-seat venue for entertainment. And it's not, I don't see the great disparity there either. They're middle-class homes, local community medicine. So, yeah, I mean, as I said, I've never seen anything like Gaza in my life. And I've been in Africa, so, I mean, I've seen poverty. I've seen real poverty, dire poverty. And there's something very unique about that place. But
one of the things which I think is most striking is that the people don't seem to be broken, and the social fabric hasn't been broken in ways that I've seen in other places. In 2010, I made a documentary in AIDS-stricken Africa. And one of the striking things, making a comparison between the Palestinians and the peoples that I saw there, is that comparably, certain spirits and values have not been destroyed here. And I did an interview with a British Jew, a member for Jews for Justice for Palestinians, a few years ago now. And he was talking about this idea that let's hope that the Palestinians do not, like others that have been oppressed, fall into drug abuse, alcohol abuse, and a destruction of the social fabric and spirit.
Mm.
And that certainly doesn't look like that's going to happen anytime soon.
Which is extraordinary, actually, because it has gone on for so very long. I mean, it's gone on for 75 years. An increasingly dire situation, an increasingly negative one, I would think, from their perspective, since it doesn't end. I mean, usually famines, if you go through history, take the Ukrainian famine, horrific, and of course it killed 7-10 million people, but it was over in a matter of 5 to 10 years. I mean, as over as anything like that gets, because the devastation lasts for history. But still, it turned around, and what is incredible there that it the situation perpetuates itself. Do you see anything in the leadership in Gaza? I mean, they're really up against the world. Are there people thinking differently? Is there any way to think differently in approaching?
I think that the Palestinian leadership has big problems, of course. I mean, I think the Palestinians haven't had an election for 7 years. I mean, this is unacceptable. If they had an election 7 years ago and nothing really on the ground has changed, why can't they have another election? There's no geographical reason. It's a political reason. It's bickering between factions. And so long as that there is no democratically elected leadership which is fresh with, I don't know, a new leader to take the Palestinians forward, there is no mandate to really do anything. And we don't really know what the Palestinians actually want. And so this is a real problem. And it's a kind of stale politics. And people here in Gaza talk about this notion of distrust of politicians now at one level, while being widespread. And I think that's obviously understandable. So I see, looking at it with a more cynical or critical eye, that the Palestinian representations are not doing a good job, because their number one priority should be that they're getting another mandate. They've actually got some legitimacy, and they've been there for 7 years. They're basically sitting on the throne, you know, and they don't have a mandate to do so anymore, actually.
They don't. Well, the last time, though, that they did vote, they voted for Hamas, and they got the censure of the entire planet. So
exactly.
I mean, do you think Hamas personally can provide leadership? I mean, are they as bad as the world insists? And, of course, that's through propaganda. So are they as bad? I mean, they fight back ineffectively.
I think that there is confusion. The thing about Hamas is, I mean, obviously no political party or anything is perfect, but one thing which I find difficult about Hamas is that its policies are not always absolutely clear, actually. For example, yesterday, the Al-Qassam Brigades, the militant wing of Hamas, released a press release saying that they will, they want all of the historic Palestine back. They want a right of return, and they will not give up any inch of the historic Palestine, the Palestinian land that was stolen 65 years ago. In Al-Nakba, the catastrophe, which is for Israel, the war of independence, which says it all. The point here is that at the same time, there are historic, there are political precedents that their policy is they would accept a two-state solution. So there is a contradiction here. And this kind of thing, I think, shows the kind of how convoluted it is, the politics here, and the lack of clarity, leadership, momentum, really, actually.
I can't see that, but I also see that there's this, if you want to call it a lack of clarity, on the other side, because people talk about a two-state solution. That's bandied about all over the world now. And you have Israel now stealing 80% of, and more actually, of historic Palestine with Palestinian mandate, as it was for some two decades under your government. But in any case, they're not going for a two-state solution. They are doing everything in their power to undermine that. So I can kind of, I mean, if I were in their position, I would be enraged and say, okay, that's it.
Indeed.
That's it. We're not going to try to negotiate because it doesn't get us anywhere.
Exactly. And this is the key. And this is, in a sense, I guess there's, and I mean this not with a negative connotation, there is the pretense of we better appear to be talking and doing diplomacy or being open to that, at the same time actually knowing that the only way really is just by resisting in whatever way that means. And this is, I guess, one of the consequences of being in a helpless or hopeless, certainly helpless position, is that all you can do is resist. You can't really get what you want. So all you do is end up being pushed into the corner of the room and shouting from it and hoping that someone pays attention and that the power game changes, the power dynamic changes.
Yes.
And this is why we see this strange politics where they're not actually particularly pushing for anything, but just resisting the Israeli entity.
I understand that. I have heard it from Arabs who live outside of that part of the world, and well, in America, that eventually the game will change. Eventually the power balance shifts and they wait for that. And I understand that, particularly with the looming war against Iran, which will be a war against Russia. The U.S., if it is drawn in, and Netanyahu is trying very hard to do that, will be devastating for the American nation.
Indeed.
And
indeed.
That's, I'm guessing, what they're waiting for. That's my personal guess. But anyway.
Great.
And I appreciate your time, and maybe we'll talk again.
We'll do it. Just email me. I'm available.
All right. Very good. Thank you.
Take care of yourself, Jennifer.
You too. You take care of yourself.